we can learn from deinstitutionalization. So first of all is a lesson, I think, which is really important around who can be decarcerated. Some of the most pervasive arguments against deinstitutionalization is the widespread belief that certain people are always going to need some kind of segregation. They're always going to need to be restrained. Some people, quote unquote, high support needs. They cannot live in the community. I'm just voicing what people say. They cannot live in the community. Some people should not be outside of prisons. But what deinstitutionalization shows us is that deinstitutionalization didn't become abolitionary until it kind of went all the way, until it was non-reformist, meaning until people, including disabled people, mad people, their families, experts, said no more. No continuum, no least restrictive environment. Warehousing people is morally bankrupt. Close them all. And when that happened, this is when deinstitutionalization became abolitionary. So not all forms of deinstitutionalization are abolitionary, but I think this is the lesson. This cannot be a choice. If we say some people need to be restrained, it makes it look viable and like it is just one choice out of many, but it is not. Genocide is not a choice. Incarcerating people, caging people, not a choice, should never be.
You're listening to Liat Ben Moshe on deinstitutionalization. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
So the question most often talked about, particularly for those who critique abolition, is about people who have the most challenging or dangerous, quote-unquote, behaviors. And in prison abolition, this is called what to do with the dangerous few. Maybe you've heard about it, right? Like a lot of people say, well, let's, you know, decarcerate, of course, people with drug offenses, blah, blah, blah. But surely there'll be people who have to be incarcerated, right? The serial killer, serial rapist. What do we do with those? And I'm using that language also because, you know, I teach, and that's really like the first thing that the students kind of raise their hands like, what about the serial killers? You know, I don't want to kind of divert that question. I just want to say that this is also happens in the realm of disability when people talk about what about the people who with the most significant or profound disabilities. So I see kind of like a mirror question here. In both cases, the general assumption is that these are the population that will not be able to kind of make it on the outside and therefore will always require some sort of segregation and restraint, either for their own good or for the public's good. But through the lens of abolition, or what I was telling you earlier, what I call a crip or mad of color critique or disability justice, we can use this question to develop what Angela Davis called a very different social landscape of a non-carceral society. To me, the question of the dangerous few in regards to the question of deinstitutionalization, for example, was to start from the quote-unquote dangerous few. So a lot of institutions that closed down in the arena of intellectual and developmental disabilities, for example, started with the people with the quote-unquote most profound needs. And I mean like really like medical needs, people who you said they will always live in some kind of, you know, hospital-y environment. People who have complex, you know, behavioral needs and so on. But if you start the work of abolition and decarceration from that, then it's very easy to then decarcerate people that have less needs for support, medical needs, and so on. This, I think, is a very profound thing for us to understand abolition, because the current focus, unfortunately, especially in criminal justice reform, is on what people call the non-non-nons, right? The non-violent offenders, non-serious offenders. I'm using the word offender because that's the system word. The non-sexual offenders. Like, yes, of course, let's decriminalize marijuana, maybe decriminalize all drugs. Why we're so progressive? This is amazing, but we don't actually go to the question of, you know, what about people with actual, you know, real challenging like behaviors, this is a big lesson from deindustrialization, is that we have to start there. And I think this is also the core of feminist thinking. This is the core of Black Lives Matter, right? In order for Black Lives Matter, trans Black lives need to matter, and so on and so on. You always start from the most marginalized. I mean, this is how liberation happens. I think this also eschews the question of violence, because the focus on the non-non-nons masks the violence of the state and lets state apparatuses define what violence means. So, you know, if you spit on a guard in a prison, that's violence, but incarceration is not. And that is incredibly problematic. And so, as abolitionists say, you know, the real serial killer is the state. The dangerous few question completely askews the analysis and what we're talking about. So I promised that I would end, I could go on and on talking about other lessons of deindustrialization, but I promised that I would end a little bit with now. Now meaning in the US, we are in an era of deindustrialization. Deindustrialization is not a failure. It actually succeeded. It did not lead to, you know, the rise of incarceration, or not in a kind of one-to-one situation. Again, a lot of states did not decarcerate as much as we would like them to. So what happens now? Well, unfortunately, I want to give some examples of the political economy of not incarceration, but decarceration. What does it look like now? In 2015, the American Friends Service Committee, with grassroots leadership, authored a report called The Treatment Industrial Complex. This is where we're now. We're not just in the institutional industrial complex. We're not just in the prison industrial complex. I think we're in the treatment industrial complex. The treatment industrial complex shows the shift on the part of the incarceration industry into areas like mental health and basically what we call alternatives to incarceration. So, for example, GEO, which is, of course, the second largest private prison company in the U.S., created a subsidiary called GEO Care, which provides mental health services in prison, in addition to operating state psychiatric hospitals that have forensic units. And, of course, the irony of a for-profit company providing mental health services to counter the disabling effects of its own prisons should not be lost to anybody. This is what I call carceral ableism, or in this case, carceral sanism. And sanism is the oppression that people with mental health differences face, or actually the imperative to be sane and the pressures and the oppression that is caused by that, that is sanism. So carceral ableism or carceral sanism are the praxis and belief that people with disabilities need special or extra protections in ways that often expand and legitimate their further marginalization and incarceration. For example, mental health jails. I can't tell you how much that is pervasive right now. You know, in recent meetings that I've been at with people who do national kind of organizing against new facility, you know, under the banner of no new jails, no new prisons, a lot of these proposed prisons are about creating either mental health jails or jails that will help with the opioid crisis so that people can, like, you know, sleep it off or whatever. So it's this idea of, right, GEO care. It's about caring. We're getting into the caring thing. And it's, again, care and profit or both. This is one example, drug courts, mental health courts. All of this is carceral ableism and carceral sanism. It might be clear to everybody in this room that you cannot cage people and say that you care. But I want you to also think about, again, the mad and disabled knowledge that tells us that this is also about biopsychiatry itself. This is not about just what's happening in a cage. It's not just about what happens behind bars. It's that biopsychiatry is often the only form of treatment that we think of, and the first course of action for people. So when we say treatment, what do we mean? And do we not mean assimilation? I think this is a really important question, and this is not just a question about what happens behind bars. And of course, we have, you know, the example of community treatment orders, which is basically people are forced to take medication, so pharmaceuticals and so on. But I'm talking even beyond when people are not forced to take the medications. But also when we say defund police, hire social workers, right? What does that mean? People need more mental health care and not criminalization. Is mental health not related to criminalization? Is it not related to surveillance? Does it not lead to further incarceration? Does it not lead people to be then incarcerated in a psychiatric unit? Is a psychiatric unit not carceral? It's not prison. That's true. But is it not carceral? And this is also really important to think about in relation to racialization as well. So in conclusion, what a CRIP or Mad of Color critique of incarceration and abolition might give you is that it's not just about people who identify or politicize as disabled people of color, although it's incredibly important to recognize the high numbers of people with disabilities who get shot by police, for example. Again, it's a framework that's based on the oppression of people of color, particularly anti-blackness and indigeneity, particularly through settler colonialism. It was built through that frame. Ableism is built on that. It's about centering the experiences of disablement and ableism and sanism in criminal, racial, and social justice movement. It's about understanding carceral ableism and carceral sanism. It's about understanding the disabling nature of incarceration itself and not blaming deinstitutionalization for it. It's about understanding that carcerality happens not just in prisons. And it's about understanding that disability and madness are fundamental to our understanding of incarceration and of abolition. That disability broadens our conceptualization of incarceration, and that criminalization is only one pathway leading to carcerality and surveillance. And criminalization is very tied to racialization, very tied to pathologization. And lastly, that we need a lot of collaboration and coalition building between disability, mad, anti-psychiatry, self-advocates, and prison and police, abolitionists and scholars. Thank you.
Okay. So I'm a child psychiatrist who's been feeling some moral injury because of the whole way our system is not functioning. I love your term, the treatment industrial complex. So one of the things that's happened in Pennsylvania, they got rid of a lot of programs for children that were community and school-based, and now children go in and out of hospitals, and they get pumped up with a lot of medication that they really don't need. This field itself says that 70% of kids don't need the medication they're on. There's been a 4,000% increase in children being placed on medications, and they go in and out of these hospital spaces, which often do not provide treatment, often exacerbate trauma and injury. And my job is just to keep things going, but not really address the real needs and issues.
I'm an ex-social worker who now studies mental health courts and treatment in jails and prisons. And my question is partially just related to the language of prisons and the language of courts and alternatives to incarceration, being really preoccupied with this concept of rehabilitation. I'm super curious about the ways that rehabilitation and sort of healthism begin to intersect with what we see in even like the word corrections. And I think that there's this really interesting like imperative to cure that happens to be particularly prevalent in the criminal legal system's treatment of madness. And I would love to hear from other folks who maybe have thoughts or insights about the ways that our system of quote unquote fixing people who have criminal thoughts or behaviors, also in quotes, intersects with the way that psychiatry operates around pathologizing and treating and assimilating people.
I was wondering if you might be able to say more or something more specific about 988 and its development. If you can say also some more about peer-run compliant respite centers, that's something that I've been really interested in. I want to say that I'm part of this organization, a startup organization in the city of Cambridge, Massachusetts, called HART. And one of the things that's been happening in our preliminary calls is that parents with children with both physical and developmental disabilities have called us for just childcare. There's a person whose child is autistic, and she's called us several times just so she could take a nap. And that's one of the things that we could offer. So I'm just thinking about these sorts of things, if you have stuff to say on all of that. Thank you.
I'm an internist, but I do addiction medicine and integrated medicine. And I'm also autistic and ADHD. What I'd like to hear more about is not just advocacy for people with disabilities, but also our self-advocacy, right? Nothing about us without us, but also our involvement in our own liberation and our own, well, that's basically it. I think the medicalization problem I've been dealing with my entire career, trying to figure out what it is that I'm supposed to do. I think we have a belief within our training that we are the experts. We know what's needed, what everyone needs. But what we really need is a culture where the person who has the lived experience is the expert, and we are there to help them meet their own needs and understand their own values and goals. It's only a disability when we're not accommodated for the things that make us different. It's really important to also emphasize that that diversity isn't an impairment necessarily. It's actually a different way of being merely, right? It's a strength of mine to look at the world through my autism. And I often wonder what makes the neurotypical think that they see things more clearly than I do. In fact, the most essential thing there is I don't understand how neurotypicals think they can read each other's minds, right? That's really what they say, and I don't think it's real. I think that leads to a lot of problems rather than solutions, so thank you.
Thank you so much for this amazing engagement. One of the things that I think is connected to a lot of the questions is about peer support, peer accountability, and mutual aid. And I know that for a lot of people, that is not enough of an answer of what is the vision, or what should we do, or what's the alternative, but it really is a lot of that. And that's also the issue with the 988. So specifically with the 988, you know, which is the hotline that's been rolled out in recent weeks. It used to be a hotline for suicide prevention, and now it's a hotline for everybody in mental health crisis. The idea behind it is that it's whoever you call, you know, is not going to kind of bring armed people into your home. But I don't think that we have enough information about who did the rolling out and how much involvement there was from actual MED people, particularly people of color, particularly people who are closer to this nexus of what I call racial criminal pathologization, meaning exactly this kind of nexus that creates increased risk to death and other harms by the hands of police, by the hands of doctors, by the hands of incarceration, more generally the carceral state. Since we don't know how much involvement there was, I'm going to assume that maybe it wasn't prominent. And I think that becomes very problematic, because the people who are going to be harmed by something like 988 is, again, this whole idea of, okay, it's not going to be cops, it will be a social worker. It's going to be, you know, somebody of that nature. But remember that social workers are also the people that can take away your kids. They're also mandatory reporters. This is a system of surveillance and tracking. Again, I'm not here trying to say everything's bad, why did, you know, not at all, but I want us to just be critical, and I want us to think about, can we do better? And can we create responses that are peer-led? Who's the best person to understand somebody in mental health crisis? It's somebody who was in mental health crisis, right? For example, there's Hearing Voices networks, both here and globally. And this is, you know, networks of people who literally hear voices that other people don't. And who's the best person to kind of talk to that experience than people who've experienced it? The same with people who experience psychosis and so on. So I think, yes, peer support. Also, in relation to the question about community care and accountability and care beyond the state, I've written quite a lot in my youth about the connection between anarchism and disability. And in a piece we called Queer Creeping Anarchism from a million years ago, we tried to propose this idea of DIY, you know, was then a very prevalent kind of thing within, especially green anarchy. You know, let's go back to the jungle and the roots and all that against the state and whatever. But the point that we try to make is to talk about things like care collectives, which are viable abolitionist like things that are happening now beyond the state. I know three people that have care collectives, meaning care collective, it's people who have personal assistance, but either the state won't pay for that or won't pay enough. And so people volunteer hours to be a part of these care collectives. Sometimes it's kind of mutual. People with disabilities don't just get cared for. They're also bring a lot to the table, and they also care for other people. And so care collectives are another example. All the networks of people that are, again, in psychosis or in crisis are another example. And then also, if people are interested in actual policies, I think there was a question about that. You know, in the U.S., people really try to, for many years, disability activism, and this is not disability justice, this is like even just disability rights people, really try to push for this idea of money follows the person. So meaning that if a person gets disability benefits, it shouldn't go to the institution or the place, which if you don't know, this is exactly what's happening. Like if you get disability benefits and you live in an institution, whether it's private or state, the money goes to the place, not the person. And so the idea is if the money goes to the person, then they can hire a personal care attendant, including their family, which, you know, do a lot of the care anyway or would want to. And this is in relation to the alternative. So, yes, join that fight. If, you know, kind of policy legalization is your jam, we need a lot of work. And then lastly, I just want to say two things. One is about this idea of, you know, not leaving people behind. This really brings the question of what Andre Gorz, G-O-R-Z, I believe, called non-reformist reforms. This idea that we can't actually let people languish while we try to abolish the thing that we're trying to abolish, right? Like people can't die in prisons because we have this idea of, okay, if you're moving to a different institution, like we failed, we have to, we do it like with the people because we are the people. The non-reformist reform, I think, is really just us on the ground figuring out, okay, we have an abolitionist horizon, but what are the steps like to achieving it while not like losing people in the process? So I think I will open it up again, and then if I have time, I'll talk about the question of corrections and rehabilitation.
Thank you so much for your talk. I'm a mother of a child with neurological differences and developmental differences, and also a co-founder of Mothers on the Frontline. And I would love to hear your advice about how to coalition with parents. We're trying to build a children's mental health justice framework for exactly these issues. We focus on the lived experience of caregivers trying to navigate these very oppressive incarceral systems. What often happens is parents are put in a position that they're trying to prevent their children from falling into school-to-prison pipeline policies of seclusion, restraint, and suspension, prevent them from being actually incarcerated, and as a result, end up over-medicating them or putting them in other carceral treatment systems. How might we all coalition together to prevent that? And the other piece of it is, because of our patriarchal system, it is mostly mothers doing this care work or female or feminized relatives, and we are being disabled by our care work. I have complex trauma, and but it's not from my child, and this is what we need to talk about. It's from the institutions that have traumatized my family. I'm afraid my other children will be taken away because of what's going on with him. I'm afraid the police will get to the school before I do because they don't know how to help accommodate his needs. So I don't know if that, but I would love to hear how we can coalition with parents rather than having this kind of division we seem to have in the activism world. Thank you.
I was thinking a little bit about, like, how do we get the care that we need, and how can people provide care to each other without burning out, without, you know, like the reliance on institutional spaces, because typically it seems like first step is someone needs care. It's usually in the nuclear family, and then it's like we don't have the resources, or like we're burnt out, or like this is too much. So then there's institutions. I'm wondering how much we could link this back to like the abolition of the nuclear family and starting new family forms, so that the family is a much bigger space that there's much more care available because we're not limiting it to this like nuclear blood type like family orientation, and instead creating a different type of family. And I'm thinking a lot about what that means, like the resources that you need for that, but how do you even just start that right now? What does it look like to actually create a space where we have enough people, we have enough resources, we're collectively sharing those, so that the care collective doesn't have to be built when you're an adult. It's like built from the time that when you're born, like you are being born into a care collective.
I'm also a parent, by the way, of a disabled now adult. You know, just to throw away some kind of resources, you know, a variety of people talk about like non-coercive. I mean, that's really kind of the issue, right? Like non-coercive and consensual things that are abolitionary. It's really important not to talk about alternatives, because think about if we would say words like, I have an alternative to eugenics. An alternative to genocide would be, you know, that is nonsensical, right? So, I mean, we should exactly do the same with incarceration. It should make no sense to us whatsoever. And I think that that's really, if it wasn't clear, like one of the deep kind of lessons from deinstitutionalization too, is like if we understand disability differently and we understand madness differently, then it would make no sense to us. And lastly, I just want to say, I don't conflate medical care with medicalization. Like, I think those are different things. I think medicalization is this kind of pathologization that we do. It's a thing that makes something like giving birth, for example, gets medicalized. A lot of things like get medicalized. But medical care is something we should all have for just living. So I think we can talk about what like affirmative medical care and mental care would mean. I don't think medicalization is the same thing. Medicalization is like the oppressive side of it. And I think this is like kind of confuses people. I don't think people with disabilities are against getting like what we need. I think we are just against the medicalization of our political identities. So thank you very much for being here.
You were just listening to Liat Ben-Moshe on deinstitutionalization. She spoke at the Socialism 2022 conference in Chicago. Liat Ben-Moshe, a disability scholar, teaches criminology, law, and justice at the University of Illinois at Chicago. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are an independent, progressive nonprofit in our 37th year. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Rami Khoury, Sarah Lee Whitson, Noam Chomsky, Chris Hedges, Arundhati Roy, and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Liat Ben-Moshe on deinstitutionalization, and for Rebecca Solnit's book, Call Them by Their True Names, American Crises, just give us a call, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go to our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just give us a call, 1-800-444-1977. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples. Find us online at cjsf.ca and on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and SoundCloud.
Listen to Scream Therapy, a show about the link between punk rock and mental health, hosted by me, Jason Schurz. I've been part of the music scene for more than 30 years. I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and my whole life was thrown sideways. As part of my recovery, I've slowly returned to the music that I love. Join me and my resilient guests for no-holds-barred conversations right here on CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser University, Thursdays at 12:30 a.m. And until then, take care and be well.